Colonel Featherby, Real 2. Now, you didn't stay at Lark Hill. The unit moved, didn't it?
The 17th Training Regiment moved from Lark Hill to Park Hall Camp at Oswestry. And then I continued with them there until around about the March time, having finished my gunner training. And they were posted to 33rd Field Regiment at Brecon.
And I guess still as a gunner, a simple gunner.
Well, I spent most of my time as a quartermaster's assistant shoveling coke out of railway wagons in Brecon goods yard for boxes of heating stone in huts.
So not much gunnery.
Very little gunnery. The regiment had just come back from Germany to be disbanded, wearing their flared battle-dress trousers, which they had doctored in Germany. They were a pretty ropey lot, and they were gradually being demobilised. And it was at that particular point in time that I started making noises about getting a commission.
Now, what made you want that, decide to do that? Because a lot of people just carry on as they are, do their national service, get out and don't bother. What made you want to go for a commission?
I'm naturally a very organising person. Yes, well, I wanted to be in charge and organise other people. I think I've been like that the rest of my life. My work is so certainly a lot of my acquaintances.
What was the procedure that you had to go through? Because it wasn't simple.
Was to put your name forward as a person who would like a commission. You were then interviewed within the unit by the commanding officer.
Do you remember the interview? What sort
of? No, I can't remember the interview at all. He obviously said, yes, you are a potential officer, so you were called a potential officer. And in due course, you were called to a war officer selection board, which was a 3-day test of command tasks, taking things across water and bridges and this, that, and the other.
Do you remember much about that? Cause
not a lot, except, I mean, it is done today exactly the same. When you see television programs about potential officers on the television, the task is exactly the same, and you were tested, and I think there were about 125 of us on that for the course, and I think about 35 got through.
What were they, do you think they were looking for? Were they looking for initiative or command skills, or what exactly was it they were after?
They first of all, I think they wanted you to be fairly intelligent, unless you were going to be a member of the academy, where being unintelligent is perhaps an attribute. Anyway, to be a gunner, one of the things about being a gunner, of course, is you had to have mathematics. So, because although they were not teaching you mathematics, you became an officer, and you did have to understand how it could work. So they wanted you to be capable of simple mathematics. They certainly wanted you to be able to control other people and organise them in such a way that they actually did what you asked them to do. Now, you could say they should have done what they were told to do anyway, but life doesn't like work like that always. And you just have to bleed a little bit. And you've also got to be able to sort out the problem and make sure you can see the answer to the difficult problem. How do you get that bucket of sand from one side of that imaginary river to the other with the ropes and the wires and things? Anyway, it worked, and eventually I was listed to go to Mons Oxford School.
Was it still regarded as important that you went to what they might call the right school or had the right social class, would you say? Was that in any way taken into consideration?
It must have been a consideration in those days, because life is rather prejudiced at that time, and I think I wasn't aware of it, except in the sense that if you looked at the persons who were actually ended up in your section at Mons, a lot of them, I would say the majority of them, were public school boys of boarding school type. So I don't think there were many of us who perhaps gone to day schools, and certainly few who've gone to what would be the equivalent of comprehensive schools today.
Now, you were at the Mons
Officer Cadet School.
Where's that at?
Hold a shot, and I can actually produce a photograph of my squad there.
And what was the setup there? How was the cadet school organised?
Well, it was organised in infantry training for a certain number of weeks, and then specialist gunner training. You came in a section or squad, and you carried out basic infantry drills, section commanders. Drills, and you used your fellow cadets as soldiers, and then one person was designated to be the platoon commander, if you like, for a day or for a week, and then you turned around and you carried out infantry training, rifle, machine gun, no grenades, they were considered to be highly dangerous, and then after that, starting on the gunner training.
And the gunner training, was it how much further? This is where you'd go into the background to how the artillery board worked and
yes,
things, wouldn't it?
They trained you up to be what was called a troop leader. A troop leader in a field regiment of 25 pounders was the junior officer who led the guns onto the gun position. He would not, at that time, have, in fact, been totally capable of carrying out the command post duties of a gun position officer. In fact, when I eventually dropped into a regular regiment, I felt completely at sea because I hadn't been properly trained, in my view. So they trained her up to a certain standard. And that was it.
So you start to understand the mathematics behind the artillery board, the other things, but you wouldn't have a complete grasp of gunnery or the science of gunnery. Well, I mean, the more sophisticated elements of gunnery, like the climatic, the effects of the climate, there's different weathers, the things like that. Were you being introduced to them or different types of barrages? I mean, some of them had gone out of date, but things like creeping barrage or predicted barrages, stonks?
You really only had a very limited idea of those particular techniques of gunnery. Certainly at Mons, anyway. All that was taught to you when you got into a regular regiment.
And what anything else about your training there? So you had this level of technical training to a certain degree. You had your infantry training. What else? Was there any more practical experience on the guns, or were you introduced to any different guns, or were you still field?
25 pounders. There was nothing else really. No.
How long did the course last for? You went in about March 48.
I didn't go to Mons in March. I had a period of time in 33rd Regiment when I was just a sergeant.
Sorry, yes. How long? Yes.
Then I went to the commissioning board and I got my place in Mons.
So when would that
and
be?
I was commissioned in August of 1948. So I probably was there 3 months, August, June, July, August. I probably went to Mons in June.
So it's quite a short course.
Yeah.
And was the threat of being RTU'd? I mean,
a number were, yes. Yes, it was fairly vigorous pressure on one to complete the exile. I mean, I think intellectually it wasn't that difficult to achieve. The problem, I think, was that the number of people who were RTU'd were not really RTU'd for other than being bloody idle, quite honestly, and not really understanding what to do about. I think if you got there and you kept your nose cleaned and you worked hard, you'd come out as an officer.
Which is what you did.
Which is like what you do in university nowadays. There are not many people RTU'd from universities these days, are there?
Anything else about your time at Mons Officer Cadet School?
I did learn to drink a little bit in Aldershot, I must admit. And the Pegasus Public House, which was the airborne pub.
Were you drinking more then?
Yeah, well, I used to drink a fair amount, because I came from a brewing family. I mean, my father was working for a brewery and a fair amount to get home.
You drink beer? Bitter.
In those days, yes.
Was there much drunkenness amongst the cadets? Out and out drunkenness, or was it more social drinking?
No, it wasn't very much. We couldn't have a couple of times. We were tired. No, we didn't drink a lot until we got in the regiment.
So the next thing would be you were commissioned in August 1948.
That's right. I mean, like a lot of other people, they asked you where you wanted to serve. And I think they said, well, we don't mind where we serve. And we indicated that you can go to the Near East, Far East. I got sent to Durham, which was a bit of a blow. But, in fact, it was the most brilliant posting I think I could have.
Now, who was it to?
45th Field Regiment.
And
part of Tyne & Tees division, which was the
50th. So, well, they were based in Durham. Whereabouts in Durham?
Ransworth Castle. Home of the DLI, of course.
And what was your reception? They were regulars, presumably, were they?
They were regular regiment, yeah.
And how did they receive you? You'd come in as a young commissioned officer, second lieutenant. How did they take you in and inculcate you into their ways?
Well, I mean, it was unfortunate. As soon as I got there, I was put on the 1500 weight and taken to by a battery, which was on the ranges of Otterburn, and I dropped off in the middle of a very cold night, I remember, in the middle of Otterburn ranges. Actually, yes, it was Otterburn ranges.
And that was which battery, do you remember?
70 battery.
And this is when you felt at sea, was it?
Yeah, I mean, in those days, you know, they didn't issue you with a sleeping bag. All you got were three or four blankets. And an officer, you didn't get a sleeping bag. And for a long time, I used my father's sleeping bag from the First World War. There was very little thought to looking after one's person. It was a regiment that had a fair number of long-serving regular soldiers, long-serving regular officers, a number of officers who had applied for regular commissions from their wartime commissions, war emergency commissions, and applied for regular commissions. And a lot of national servicemen and people on, you know, 2 years. In fact, the National Service Act didn't come into force until the 1st of August 1948. So we were War Emergency called up people. We were called up before the 1st of January. Because we were only supposed, those of us who were War Emergency in those days, were only supposed to do 18 months. In fact, we were eventually called to the square and told that we were going to be kept for 2 years because of the bow and arrow. And that was a bit later on. I suppose it was also very strange and different being in an officer's mess in Brunswick Castle. We lived in the castle itself. It was bloody cold that winter, I remember.
What was the officer's mess like? How formal? Or what would a typical evening be like? That's another way of looking at it.
It was generally, unless one was training, one had to put on one's best uniform and sit down to a formal dinner.
Every night?
About 3 nights a week, I think. A lot of all the officers' duties to do, turn out the guard in the middle of the night.
What about the mess notes? I mean, so you'd be there in fairly formal uniforms. Not I mean, best uniforms.
We only had service dress. We didn't have blues. So we put our service dress on at night instead of battle dress.
And how formal was the meal? Was it the passing the port and the toasts? Or
the 3 nights that were formal, yes.
What about some of the older regimental things like mess games or traditions of not talking about religion and the rest of it? Was any of that still?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, we did have fairly drunken nights occasionally because the lads from the war, they were fair old drinkers. And that continued in the TA as well. It was even worse in the TA than it was in the later on. We seemed to enjoy it all. The thing about being in a regular regiment at that time was that if you had a job to do, like being depot battery in Otterburn, that was absolutely brilliant because you were responsible for going out with all the TA regiments, all the regular regiments that came into Otterburn. If they were short of a safety officer or they were short of a GPO or a gun position officer or even a CPO, command post officer, they would say to the depot battery, well, can you give us a lad and a team to fill in? And I got so much gunnery training and it was absolutely brilliant. When I was back at Brunswick Castle, when we changed the depot batteries around, I mean, you were standing on the square most of the day, just doing nothing.
So
that was when I felt at times it was a waste of time.
So, looking at the depot battery, because that's quite, because when you first got there, you said you were all at sea with the gunnery.
Yeah, I mean, we had so little experience, it was extremely difficult. But one learned very quickly. You had to, because, you know, somebody would say, right, here's your team, you've got a simulator, you've got a driver, you've got a vehicle, you've got a surveyor, etc., etc. Go and be a GPO for this TA unit coming into this firing camp. And you just had to get on with it.
So, although your inexperience was exposed, you felt you soon got used to it.
Yes. And I mean, I'm enjoying it as well. It's helped because I mean, my one strong subject, looking back educationally, was maths and chemistry. Chemistry was useless, but the maths was useful. And you know, it all fell into place. And I thoroughly enjoyed it and had a marvellous time firing day after day after day.
How long would the depot battery duty last? How long was 70th there?
I think we would be there. I think it would be about 3 months I was depot battery. Of course, there wasn't a lot of firing in the winter period, but then I got glandular fever and I was sent off to Catrick Military Hospital for a altogether about 5 weeks. But I certainly came home for Christmas, then went back to hospital again.
How bad were you with it?
I was quite well. You see, the trouble is there was nowhere you could be ill in Brunswick Castle. It was cold. It was miserable in the winter. It really was pretty grim.
The DLI had gone, hadn't they, by then?
The DLI depot was there. Their headquarters depot was there.
They hadn't gone back to
France. They got a little museum there. And I think there was a major so-and-so, and the DLI was there, kind of keeping track of it.
How did you get on with your men? Because, you know, it's for a junior officer, it's always a key thing.
I had an extremely good sergeant major, Yanto Jones, who was brilliant, and he really did look after me. And I also had a very good motor transport bombardier. But he looked after me very well, and I had a very good drive.
Were you aware of the importance of accepting advice from senior NCOs who, you know, or your NCOs?
Yes, I mean, I think you did rely upon them. I mean, you know, I say, Sergeant Major Jones, what do I do about this Sergeant Major? And you say, well, if you're a prat, you're going to do so and so. But if you do what I tell you, you'll probably be all right, you know. And it worked. I mean, if people had all been against you, you'd have been in an awful mess.
And what about,
as far as the governor is concerned, you could always go to the senior sergeant surveyor and say to him, look, I don't know how to do this. Can you just take me on one side and show me how to do it? And they would do it, yeah.
And what about the actual gunners, the men you were commanding? How did you get on with them?
Oh, right, yes. Some of the soldiers.
What was the secret of a good relationship? I mean, some people say it's to be disciplined, some people say it's not to be disciplined. You know, I mean, why did you get on reasonably well with the soldiers you commanded, you think?
I don't really know. I mean, I've never had any trouble with soldiers or anybody else for that matter, but I mean, I think it's just a bit of a grin and a... cups of tea used to go around bombing opposition every time you went around. Have a cup of tea, sir, you know, and you've got thinking, well, drinking out of a cup of tea with about five daily gunners, getting pharyngitis and all the things my father used to say he got in the First World War from drinking out the same cup. But we did it, and it seemed to work. Now, of course, we've got girls on the guns. When you go around the gun position, now we've got girls there.
We'll come back to that, when we come. Were you aware of your responsibilities to them, you know, that you had to look after the men first?
Well, yes, we were always taught, you know, you feed the horses first, then the men, and then yourself. And we got bollocks if we didn't, you know, make certain that the chaps had got that meal at the finish today. And we'd have to go and see them in the cookhouse to make sure it was all right. And that kind of background has always been strong in the South, not as ours particularly. And we still talk about having, well, we did for the first 20 years in the South, not as ours, talk about having stables in the morning when we maintain the vehicles.
What about it, with your 70th battery? I mean, there were presumably a disparate bunch by then, coming from various sources, different types of conscription, different types of volunteers,
yes.
People hanging on from the... how did they all meld together? I mean, was there any friction or different types?
I think there was. Yeah, I mean, some of them went, some got demobilised and went, and you got another conscript in his place.
When you started getting the actual conscript, the National Service conscripts, as opposed to the War Emergency conscripts, was there any difference? No particular reason it should be, but did you notice any change in the nature of the conscripts?
Of course, you see, the fact that it was only the terms of engagement that were different. The people who were called up prior to the 1st of January 1948 were exactly the same kind of people who were called up after the 1st of January 1948, really. So you really didn't notice the difference between whether it was a war emergency call a man or a national serviceman.
And there was no sort of decline in enthusiasm as you got further away from the war, and, you know, it all seemed less relevant.
I suppose if one was being realistic about it, a lot of people were being called up, as had been prior to the 1st of January 1948, who probably felt, well, I could have gone to university, or I could have started my career, or I could have done this, or I could have done that, and why have I got to do 2 years? And all right, if you were sent abroad, okay. If you were on the square in Brunswick doing very little, it must have been an awful boring kind of 2 years.
And you yourself found it boring at Brandsmouth.
Yes, I mean, the day in barracks at Brandsmouth Castle really was maintenance of the vehicle. I mean, we used to do ridiculous things to the vehicles. I mean, totally.
What sort of things?
Well, first of all, if you had a vehicle, you had a driver. The driver was told to carry out certain tasks, and he'd have a list of tasks, and he'd do it religiously on the day of the month when he was told to do it. For instance, they used to take the plug out one day. They used to clean the distributor one day. They used to do this. Now, by the time you've done this twice a month, the bloody distributors were all floppy and the plugs used to fall out and the vehicles never worked very well because you kept on. I mean, you don't do that with your car now, do you? And because they wanted something for people to do, they had these tasks for them to keep them occupied, and it was totally unrealistic. You know, cleaning the petrol pump. And by the time you take a petrol pump to pieces and you dethread, crazy. And the wireless sets,
What was the equipment you had would all be presumably wartime? Was it wear? I mean, other than the unnecessary maintenance, was it wearing out? Were there problems with replacements?
Yes, the equipment wasn't in a very good state. I mean, the wireless sets have got Russian writing on them because they've been made to send to Russia, and never got there. And those were being used well into the late '40s, early '50s. The army didn't get any. It's got the same problem now. It hasn't got a decent radio to its name. You junior officers were made to carry out a 406 inspection, which was an inspection of a vehicle. Now, I've never inspected a vehicle in my life until I got on the square at Brunswick Castle, and a certain MT sergeant said, "Here you are, sir. It's your job to inspect this vehicle and fill in a report for him." I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" He said, "Well, you feel the wheel bearings to see if the wheel bearings are right, and you do this, and you get underneath, and you put your road poles on, and you do the prop shaft, and make sure that the universal joints are not." I said, "Well, I wouldn't know how much steel it's supposed to be." I mean, it was as crazy as that. It just did something for you to keep you occupied.
What about, was there unnecessary maintenance of the guns as well?
Well, I think there probably was, yes. I mean, there's quite a lot to do on a £25 if you do it properly.
What sort of thing?
Well, I mean, we used to boil them out after they're fired. I mean, you don't boil guns out nowadays, but I mean, you used to get hot water in a soil stove and put water in it, and rifles were all boiled and cleaned out, and they don't do that nowadays. We've all now discovered this to be a waste of time. But it was just... They maintained the regiment and filled its time up with unnecessary tasks. Well, what else could they do? I mean, you could criticise it, but if the Ministry of Defence and the War Department said, "We want so many field regiments," they can't all go firing every day in England, can they?
I was wondering whether you actually had much firing. I mean, other than when you were the depot battery and you were assigned.
You probably only fired 4 weeks out of the year.
And that would be your summer camp? Well,
probably you'd go to fortnight camps. Then you did your gunnery training then.
What was the standard of the gun drill and the actual swiftness of loading the guns and of the actual accuracy of the fire?
I don't think it was particularly high. Just shortly after I left 45th Field Regiment, they made up the artillery for Korea. The 14th Regiment went. Some of our people went from 45th Field. They would have given them a prolonged period of training up Rock Hill. And I think all the skills were probably there. but it required, like it does in the TA, a length of time in order to bring them up to the state of readiness which was necessary for them to see action. And going back to 48, there were still people, still regiments being taken out of the line and disbanded, and there was that feeling about